Chris, I wanted to just finish up very much for Kitzer, that we mentioned that after the Meraglim, the Torah gives us three mitzvahs that we are supposed to keep. And as they say, there will be a machlokas. Some say there were no mitzvahs given after the Meraglim until the 40th year. Others say that the punishment of the Meraglim did not take effect until the next Tisha B'Av, so they still got mitzvahs that particular year, because the only people that died that year were the Meraglim themselves. The people didn't begin dying until the next year. So those three mitzvahs are, first of all, the mitzvah of challah, second of all, the mitzvah of nesachim, and third of all, the mitzvah of sittis. So just to go briefly to be sure that you know what these mitzvahs are, when we hear the word challah, we of course think of the bread that we eat, but challah does not refer to the bread. Challah refers to the portion from dough that is given to Kohanim. And that is, the Torah says that when you make a dough from the five species of grain, wheat, barley, rye, oats, and spelt, right? The same minim that you make alamichyan, the same minim that if they're bread you make hamotzian. So if the dough is of a certain size, you're mechuyev to be mafrish a portion of that dough and give it to a Kohen. And the name of that designated portion is challah. How much dough do you have to make in order to be mafrish challah? So the Torah's lashon is, reishis arisoseichem, the first or the choicest of your dough. Now what does it mean, your dough? Your dough is the amount that you got every day in the month. So the shear of challah depends on the daily portion of mun. Any bread dough that is the size, or the volume rather, of the shear of the isas midbar is chayev in challah. Now, how much do they get every day in the mun? So the Torah says they got a tenth of an ephah. Right? So the shear of the isas midbar is a tenth of an ephah. What does that translate into? So the Mishnah says it is the volume of 43 and the third eggs, the volume of 43 and a third eggs. But without getting into a very complicated shaila, there is a big machlokes based on computation, whether the eggs in the time of Chazal or the Torah were much larger than ours. And there is the famous shita of the Neida B'Yehuda, who basically says that our eggs are only one half the size of the ancient eggs, and he proved this from a very complicated proof. And as a result, all shiurim of eggs have to be doubled. Now,
the
beitza. Yeah, and I understand kibetza, but Nebuta says every beitza is two beitza. I mean, that's what Nebuta says. Every shear is doubled because the beitza of the Torah was doubled. Now, other people argue with that, and the shear of beitza has a very, very important relevance to the shear of kezias, because kezias is described not simply as an olive, but a kezias is described as a ratio of a beitza. It's either a half of a beitza or a third of a beitza. So if the beitza gets bigger, the kezias gets bigger. Yeah?
Does that also mean that he holds that the chickens were bigger?
Well, that's the old story of the chicken and the egg, you know. No, Lavdav, I don't think he says the chickens were bigger, but you know, listen, the size of a bird's egg is not always correlative to the size of the bird. There are small birds that lay big eggs, and vice versa. Now, because of this suffix, the bottom line is this. I'll just give you a bottom line, so in case any of you are bakers, you should know. And that is, if you have a dough that contains between 2.5 up to 5 pounds of flour, but not five, your mafrish challah without a bracha, because misafek, that would be the 43 and a third eggs using the smaller amount. But you don't make a bracha because it's a safek. When you have 5 pounds or more, then you are mafrish challah with a bracha, because then you have complied even with the bigger shear of the Neida B'Yehuda. So a dough that has less than 2.5 pounds of flour, you're not mafrish challah at all. Between 2.5 and up to 5, not including 5, your mafrish challah without a bracha. 5 and above, your mafresh challah with a bracha. Now, I'm not going to discuss all the halacha. There are many halachas here. We don't have to go into a detailed halacha of challah. Let's say I have several small doughs that I'm working with, but together they're 5 pounds. When are you mitzareif them? When are you not mitzareif them? Etc. That's a whole issue. And also, let me just remind you, too, that challah requires that the product be baked. So if you're making dough to fry as donuts, you would not be mafresh challah. If, on the other hand, you're making cake batter, even though it's thin, but cake batter is going to be baked in dry heat, you are mafresh challah. So you are mafresh challah from bread dough, from cake dough, from cookie dough. In other words, even if it's mazonos, it doesn't have to be something you'll make hamotzi on, but you're not mafresh challah from dough that you're going to deep fry for donuts or the like. Again, it's parallel to the halachas that anything baked potentially could be a hamotzi if you ate enough of it. Right? That's the siga pasuk baba kistan. Fried dough could never be hamotzi. So, because even if you ate 20 donuts, you would not make hamotzi, right? Because the din of pasuk baba kistan is only a rule in baked mizonos. It is not a rule in fried mizonos. And the truth of the matter is that to some degree is connected to the laws of challah, because remember, the laws of what bracha you make on something are all rabbinic. But when the rabbis determined that every mizonos could potentially be a hamotzi, they were basing it on the rule that this is called bread for challah purposes. And therefore, the opposite is the case. Anything that could never be bread for challah purposes could also never be bread for hamotzi purposes, right? That's kind of the correlation. Okay, now the one thing I do want to go over, just very briefly, is normally challah, how much do you take off for challah, right? So you have to have this, these tenth of an eifah, which is 2.5 pounds of flour and 5 pounds of flour, or more than 5 pounds of flour. How much do you have to take off? So the araisa, challah is one of those mitzvos that do not have a shiur, meaning to say, you could just take off, it's like a truma, you could take off anything, give it to the kohen, that would be fine. But the chachamim enacted that you give the kohen a significant amount. And the significant amount is, it depends. If you're making a dough for your own internal consumption at home, you take 1/24th of the dough and you give it to the kohen, 1/24th. If you're a baker, and this is your business, Chazal gave you a break, you only have to give 1/48th, because we don't want businesses to suffer too much. Now, when I say dough, I mean that quite literally. L'chatchila, challah is separated from the dough. If, however, you did not separate it from the dough, you already baked the bread, then you do separate it even from the baked bread. But l'chatchila, it is separated from the dough. Now, here is the thing. Bizman hazeh, we do not give challah to a kohen. The same reason that we don't give truma to a kohen, we don't give challah to a kohen. And that is bizman hazeh, because we don't have the para aduma that purifies people from the impurity of a mace, every single person in the world is treated as a tamei mace. And even the kohen, who's not allowed to go into the cemetery, but we say that there's too much mace. First of all, anyone in Chutzlars automatically is tamei mace, at least midrabanan. So that's a separate thing. Anyone from Chutzlars is considered to be tamei mace, no matter what.
Why?
It's machlokis exactly. I mean, some say because there are dead bodies buried all over the place that are not marked, because in Chutzlars they were not careful about purity. And others say Chazal just created the status because they didn't want people to go to Chutz La'aretz, so they said that they're Tamei. But even people who never left Eretz Yisrael are considered to be Bizman Hazeh Tamei Meis, because you never know, by accident, you're driving on a spread, these are always shilas. You're in a bus and the bus is going on the side of a cemetery and there's a tree that's over a grave and over the bus, you could be tamei without even knowing it. Allow flights, right? You could be tamei. These are different shilas. And not only can you be tamei because there's a dead body on the plane, usually they'll tell you that, but you could be tamei if the LL flies over a cemetery, a Jewish cemetery, at 30,000 feet. So b'derech klal, every kohen, as well as every Yisrael, is b'cheskas tamei meis, so they can't eat it. Number two, a second reason is that our Kohanim do not have definitive yichus, meaning to say we don't have family records that are 100% accurate. So even though we're makel with respect to duchening and aliyah l'torah, because the way it works is mimanafshach, you're either a kohen or not a kohen. If you're not a kohen, it doesn't count, but there's no aveira. But we're not makel for truma or eating korbanos or the like. That's a second reason. A third reason is that even if you're 100% kohen who's pure, the problem is the Yisrael who made the challah, the woman, is tameh, and she made the challah tameh. When challah is tameh, a kohen is not allowed to eat it, right? So there are three different reasons why we don't give challah to a kohen. Number one, who says he's a kohen? Number two, he's tameh. A tameh kohen cannot eat challah. Number three, even if he's tar and he is a kohen, but he's not allowed to eat tameh challah, and the challah is tameh. So what do you do when you have challah that's tameh? The halacha is you burn it. You burn it. Now here is the rub. Since the purpose of the Chachamim requiring 1/24th or 1/48th is that the Kohen should get something chashuv, when you're not going to give the challah to the Kohen anyway, and it's going to be burnt or destroyed, there is no reason to require a significant amount. So we actually go back to the Torah law that all you have to do is separate the tiniest bits. But the Rama says the minog is we separate the size of a kezias, which doesn't have to be 1/24th, it could be less than 1/24th. We separate a kezias, but Meikar Adin doesn't even have to be a kezias, it's a mashahu. And that's the same thing with Truma, by the way, Truma as well. Truma min haTorah is even one grain patters the whole thing. But the Chachamim were mechayev, they gave three levels. If you're a generous person, you give 1/40th. If you're an average person, you give 1/50th. If you're a stingy person, you give 1/60th. This is always an interesting getter that the Chachamim determined this. So you go to your rabbi and you say, how much truma should I give? And the rabbi says, well, would you describe yourself as selfish, average, or generous? You know, it's hard for a person. Well, I'm kind of on the selfish side, you know. So it's kind of a little mud in the description. But okay. But the halacha is you have to give at least 1/60th. And yet, bizman hazeh, because our kohanim do not eat truma, we actually only separate a mashu. In other words, when you separate truma, you only separate, in fact, not even a kezias, you just separate the tiniest bit, right? Because the svar is very pashut. The chachamim require, now when the Torah requires a quantity like meiser, which has to be 10%, then it makes no difference if it's going to be eaten or not. There you don't have any choice. But when the Torah says mashu, and it's only midrabanan that we have a shear, the general rule is whenever it's not going to go to somebody, you can go back to the Torah law. But as they say, that doesn't work for maser, maser sheni. Those things require 10% min haTorah, so there's no negotiation. Okay, so again, we don't have to go over all the halakas. But one thing I do want to tell you is a very, very fascinating difference between Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael. And this is a very, very interesting halakha, and it comes up a lot. That is the following. D'oraisa, challah like truma, is a mitzvah to tuluya b'aretz. It only applies to Eretz Yisrael. It does not apply to Chutz La'aretz. But interestingly enough, it has a different twist. The configuration of challah is a little different. Because unlike truma, which depends on where the produce grew, if it grew in Eretz Yisrael, it's chayiv in trumas and masras. If it grew in Chutz La'aretz, it's not chayiv in trumas and masras. Challah does not depend on where the produce grew. It depends on where the dough was made. Which means, if I took Israeli flour and I just brought it to America, of course, they're not going to let you do that. You know, in Newark Airport, they're going to go through your... in fact, just my last trip, it's very interesting. They're very strict now. They don't allow any food to come in from Israel. I'm not sure what they're concerned about. So they have these... you know, in the olden days, they used to have these German shepherds sniffing for drugs. So it looked like very serious. Now they use beagles, these cute little beagles. It's kind of like a game. and you know they sniff these drugs, you know, the beagles jumping up and down. But so there was this old Hasidish lady, sweet Hasidish lady, you know, and the dogs were going crazy. They're going crazy. Saying, "Oh, gee, is she a drug lord or what is she doing?" You know, so they strip open her suitcases and they rip it out, and they discovered she had two oranges in her suitcase. You know, she was in big trouble. They confiscated the two oranges, and everything. So. In Israel you can bring in anything. They don't check. In Israel you can bring in food. Just don't bring in an iPhone or anything. They'll get you there. But no, in Israel they don't care if you bring in food from America. But in America they really are very, very strict. They don't let you bring anything into the country. But whatever it is. But let's say you smuggled Israeli flour, you know, into the United States, and you made bread in the United States. Dough rice, you're not chayev in challah because the dough was made in chutz laaretz. Vice versa, if I brought American flour into Israel and I made the bread, I would be chayev in challah. So it's a little different. This is an unusual mitzvah tluya biaretz because it's not toloi on where it grew, it's toloi on isa. Where was the dough made? That is the critical moment. The mixing of the water and the flour. The lisha creates the mitzvah of challah. Now, notwithstanding that, that's d'oraisa. Midrabanan, however, and again, you're probably familiar with this, even if it's a dough that's made in chutz laaretz, you have to separate challah. So challah in Eretz Yisrael is the Torah's law, although even that may be drabanan today, but the mitzvah of challah in the Torah is Eretz Yisrael, but the chachamim were mechayev challah in chutz la'aretz. So you could ask a bunch of questions on this, and that is, well, gee, there are so many mitzvos that are not chayev. In other words, the rabbanan didn't mechayev truma and meiser in chutz la'aretz. They didn't say that. Why is challah the only one that they created a chiyev? Okay, that's a good question, but the bottom line is, there is a chiyuv midrabanan of challah in chutz la'aretz. Right? It's drabanan. Now, there is, however, a very interesting and significant difference between the chiyuv of challah in Eretz Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael dough, versus a chiyuv of challah in chutz la'aretz. That is, when there's a chiyuv of challah in Eretz Yisrael, until you separate challah, the isa, the dough or the bread that you baked, is tevel. You're not, just like truma. Until you separate truma, no one is allowed, even a kohen, no one is allowed to eat it. There's an iser tevel until you separate challah. But that is only in the challah of an isa of Eretz Yisrael. An isa in chutz la'aretz does not have an iser tevel, so theoretically you're allowed to eat from the bread as long as you leave over something, which you can later. And I mean, there's only one reason to do that. I'll get to that in a second. But, I mean, you might as well be mafresh right away, but I'll give you an example. So this is a big nafgamina. Chalas Eretz Yisrael has an iser tevel, and chalas chutz la'aretz does not have an iser tevel. Now, the reason why this is very important is the following. The Mishnah in Maseches Beis says that you're not allowed to separate challah or truma on Shabbos. Not allowed to do that. The Chachamim prohibited the separation of trumos and masros and challah on Shabbos. Why? Because rabbinically it looks like misake, like you're making it a kli, because you couldn't eat it, now you made it edible, etc. That's called a tikkun. So let's imagine the following scenario. Let's take an Eretz Yisrael case, then a chutz la'aretz case, and we'll see the difference. So let's say I made bread, or my wife made bread for Shabbos, made challah, we call it, for Shabbos, and she forgot, or I forgot, to separate the challah. So now we have, as it were, untithed challah. So if we're in Eretz Yisrael, I am in big trouble, because I am not allowed to be mafrish the challah, because that's Isser Midrabanan. And I'm not allowed to eat the bread until I'm mafrish challah, because that's tevel. So that bread is simply prohibited. Not only that, happens to be muktzah as well. Since it's prohibited to eat, it's even prohibited to move, because it's something that's not royally achila on Shabbos, and it is muktzah. So there is no Eitzah, there is no Takana, there is nothing you can do. You have to get bread from somebody else. But if the same thing happened in New York, that I had forgotten to take off challah, so here is the thing. I still cannot be mafresh challah. I can't take off a piece and say, this is challah. But what I can do is, I can take off a piece of bread and not say anything. I'm not designating it as challah, but I just put it away. And then we can eat the bread on the smach that right after Shabbos, I'm going to proclaim this piece as challah and burn it. Because even though I wasn't mafresh challah till after Shabbos, but in Chutz La'aretz, there is no Isser Tevel. And since there is no Isser Tevel, so you can eat the bread and be mafresh the challah after Shabbos. So so I guess maybe this is the one advantage of living in Chutz La'aretz. There are no other advantages at all, but this is the one leniency we have with the challah of Chutz La'aretz. Okay? Now, it is a very interesting halacha. The Beis Yosef, the Mechaber, brings a fascinating halacha that's a little intricate in terms of the laws of Tumah. And he says the following. He says, a person should be very, very careful to make their dough, to knead their dough, with one of these seven liquids. Now, there are seven liquids. You know the halacha? The halacha is that food cannot be makabel tuma unless it is called mukshur, unless it's come in contact with certain liquids. Like an apple, right? An apple, even when it was on the tree and it was raining, but when it's mechubar lekarka, that's not hechsher. So an apple that's harvested, even if I'm tumay and I touch it, the apple does not become tumay until it comes in contact with liquids. The liquids can include water, wine, usually be water, etc. If I wash the apple, it's mukshar lekabel tuma, but otherwise it's not mekabel tuma. Now, the seven mashkim include water, dew, wine, milk, honey, this actually might be bees honey as opposed to the shivas aminim, which is date honey. But for the point I want to make is, the one thing that's not mashke is fruit juice other than wine. So for example, if I just knead a dough with apple juice, let's say pure apple juice for a moment, just to keep it simple, the challah, the dough, does not become mukshir lekabel tuma. So what's the problem with that? So the Beis Yosef brings the following halacha. It is not proper to burn challah that hasn't become tameh. So, if you knead your dough with fruit juice that is not one of the Shiva Samashkin, then even though you're a tameh mace, you have not made the challah tameh. So you now have a dilemma. You can't give it to a Kohen because the Kohen is tameh and not miyuchas. But you're not allowed to burn it because you're not allowed to burn challah that's tahora. So the Mechaber says you're not allowed to knead a dough unless you knead it in such a way that it becomes mukshir lekabel tuma, and therefore it becomes tameh. And once it's tameh, I'm allowed and I'm commanded to burn it. But this is a very interesting halacha. Now again, this is complicated. Usually it's not a problem because people knead it with water or whatever it is. But if you use just apple juice, so you do get a shaila about what is called reconstituted juice, because a lot of the juices we have, in fact, were mixed with water. So the question becomes, does that become water? Does that become juice? You know, is it machshir? And the like. Okay? So that's kind of for now. Again, the Hilchos Challah has many other halachas, but this is just to be aware of the basic mitzvah of challah. Also, challah is a bit unique. Certain mitzvahs in the Torah only kicked in after the Jews conquered and divided Eretz Yisrael. And that took 14 years, meaning the mitzvah did not apply for the 14 years. Some mitzvahs kicked in as soon as they came to Eretz Yisrael. Challah is unique. Challah began as soon as they came to Eretz Yisrael. It did not require the Yud Dalet Shanim of Kibush V'Chiluk. So if any of you are interested in ever making a chart, you can just make a chart. Which mitzvahs apply after 14 years and which mitzvahs applied right away. Shemitah, for example, did not apply till after the 14 years. They did not have to keep Shemitah the first 14 years they were in Eretz Yisrael, because that required the division of the land into tribes. A challah does not require that. Okay, so that's mitzvah number one. Mitzvah number two is a mitzvah, again, that some people misunderstand the picture, and that is that when you bring certain korbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, the korban has to be accompanied with a mincha, a meal offering, of flour that is mixed with oil, and a wine libation. Right? So it's a mincha and the sochim, and the size of the flour and the wine libation depends on one of three animals, right? The smallest animal is a lamb, a keves, which is 1 year or less. And then you have an ayal, which is a ram. A ram is a male sheep that's in its second year or above. And then we have a par, a bull, which is the biggest. And once again, without going into the exact amount, the smaller the animal, the lesser the amount, the higher the animal, no, the bigger the animal, the higher the amount, a par, etc. A par, ayal, and keves. Now, this, keep in mind, is only, this is brought only for a korban ola, a burnt offering, or a korban shlamim, or a peace offering. If a person brings a chatas, a sin offering, or an asham, a guilt offering, those types of korbanos, there are no menachos or nesachim that are brought. Now, that's one point to keep in mind. This is only for ola and shlamim. At the same time, however, what's important to understand is that this applies whether it's an optional korban or an obligatory korban, meaning it makes no difference if it's a korban ola I want to bring, or whether it's the korban tamid that was brought every day. Right? In other words, if it's an ola, you had these nesachim. If it was a chatas or an ashim, you didn't have these nesachim on them. It makes no difference. Olas chova, olas nedava, that makes no difference. But the one thing I do want you to know is that the mincha that is brought as an appendage to the ola and shlamim is fundamentally different than the mincha that is brought as a freestanding offering. In other words, it's interesting. The mincha that is brought as an appendage to the korban, that is described in Parsha Shlach, this parsha, or, you know, yesterday or last week's parsha. But the mincha that is brought as a freestanding offering is described in Parshas Vayikra and Sav. And there, that's very, very, very different. When I want to bring a mincha as a freestanding offering, the Kohen takes a portion of that mincha, burns it on the Mizbeach, and the rest of the mincha is eaten by the Kohen. A normal Korban mincha is eaten by the Kohen minus a kamitza, minus a fistful or three fingers full. It's actually three fingers, right? You have your thumb and your pinky are out. Three fingers burnt on the Mizbeach. The rest is eaten by the Kohanim in the Azara, it's Kodshei Kedoshim. But the mincha that is brought as an appendage to a korban is totally burnt on the Mizbeach, together with the wine libation. So don't confuse the fact that menachos are two different types. There is a mincha that is brought as a separate korban, I want to give a mincha, and then there's a mincha that is brought as an appendage to a korban ola or shlamim. And that goes, in the Mishnah and in the Gemara, that goes by the term minchas nesachim, although it's a little bit of a confusing term, because nesachim, we normally connect to the wine libation, but, and this is a mincha, this is the flour mixed with oil, but since together with that you had the wine libation, that is called the mincha of the nesachim. Now, another interesting point is that although it is an appendage to the korban, it doesn't have to be brought the day of the korban. Meaning, theoretically, if I bring a korban ola on Monday, I could bring the nesachim even a week later. So it's an appendage to the korban, but it does not have to be brought on the day of the korban itself. Okay? So that's the mitzvah of minchas nesachim. And as I say, it exists if it's an ola or a shlamim, and whether it's an individual korban or a communal korban, whether it's an obligatory korban or an optional korban, in the korban tamid and every musaf, which was ola and shlamim, which was olas, they always brought nesachim. You'll see in Parshas HaTamid that can you read on Rosh Chodesh, they brought the nesachim and the like. In fact, this is when they said the shir, right? We have, what do we say? We have in davening, shir shal yom. Right? Every day has a kapitel tehillim that belongs to that day. I'll mention the Graz Minhagim in a moment. Now, what is the shir shal yom? Because at the conclusion of the korban tamid of the morning, the Levim would sing a song of praise. But when would they sing their song of praise? They sang their song of praise after the korban was already on the mizbeach. They sprinkled the blood. They were burning the emurim. But as they were, and they burnt the flour and oil, and as they were pouring the wine on the mizbeach, when the kohanim were pouring the wine on the mizbeach, that is when the levim were saying their shir. So the shir shel yom is connected to the nesachim. To the Nesachim. In fact, this actually explains a very interesting chiluk in Minhagim between Ashkenazim and Sfardim, putting aside the Graz Minhagim. On a day that you have Musaf, let's say it's a day of Rosh Chodesh. Okay, so we have Shachris, we have Kriyas HaTorah, we have Musaf. When do you say the Shir of the day, Shir of the Yom, Shir of the Yom? So Ashkenazim say the shir of the yom at the end of davening, as they always do. We always say it at the end of davening. But Sfardim and Chassidim, Nusach Sfarad is a different minhag, a very logical minhag. They say it after Shachris, before Kriyas HaTorah, for a very good reason. Tefillah Shachris is keneged the Korban Tamid of the morning. When did they say the shir shel yom in the Beis HaMikdash? They said the Shir Shal Yom in the Beis HaMikdash after the Korban Tamid of Shachris. So Bishlama the whole year when you don't have a Musaf. So I say it at the end of davening because that's after I finish Shmon Esrei. So I say, you know, something's before it, but essentially it's after the Shmon Esrei of Shachris. But when you have two Shmon Esreis, Sfardim say the Shir Shal Yom belongs to Shachris. It doesn't belong to Musaf. Now the Minhag Ashkenaz is to still put it at the end, and it's a difficult minhag. They say, well, since we're not actually bringing the korban, okay. Now, let me just say a few words about the minhag of the Gra, which undoubtedly confuses people who come to Eretz Yisrael. They're not familiar with these customs. And that is, the Gra basically points out that even though there is a shir of chol, but the Gemara it says in many places, that on Rosh Chodesh and on Yomim Tovim, they had a special shira, special portion of Tehillim that was miyuchad to that day. Now, the truth of the matter is, we don't have a complete record. We have a partial record of what that shir was. The Gemara does not give us a comprehensive list, but the Gra had different sources where he compiled what the shir was. So the Gra says that kishem that on a Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh, the shir of the Yom Tov superseded the shir of the day. So too in our davening, the shir of the Yom Tov supersedes the shir of the day, because that's exactly the way it was in the Beis HaMikdash, and that is why on Rosh Chodesh, right, the minhag would be, the minhag of the Grubby, instead of saying the shir of the Yom and Borchi Nafshi, we only say Borchi Nafshi. Because the Gra says the shir of the special day is docha the shir of the yom. Now, I do want to say though that this din of the Gra is very, 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 very shver, and in fact, it was criticized. Well, maybe criticized is not the right word for the Gra, but it was questioned. Questions were raised by great dayanim in Vilna. You know, if you know in the back of the Gemara, you know the shas that we have is really an offset of the Vilna Shas, right? The standard official defus of the Talmud Bavli is the Shas of Vilna. And so every Shas, even Ozor Hadar, even if they, in fact, even now they have Shas Vilna HaChadash, right? They try to make it the better type and everything, but it's based on the Vilna Shas. So the Vilna Shas really was a great masterpiece. It was produced in the 1880s and 90s. Some shuls still have an original Vilna Shas. You can actually see beautiful, beautiful work. This was the greatest Jewish printing press in Europe, in the world. The widow, Halmana Va'achim Ram. It's the Ram Press. The Ram Press was founded by a man, Rav Nachum Mendel Ram. He died very young, so his widow, his wife, and their sons handled it. So all of these svarim say Halmana Va'achim Ram. Now you may notice, though, that although they deserve it, that is why in the Meforshim, in the back of the Gemara, there's a disproportionate number of great Rabbanim from Vilna. They're kind of a little overrepresented because it was the local talent, and they got their things in. So the Rishash of Shmuel Strachan is from Vilna. So one of the people that has Hagos there is the Cheshek Shlomo, Rav Shlomo HaKohen. Now, in the newer Shasas, you're not even going to know this anymore, because in the newer Shasas, they did a very, very good thing, but for a bibliophile, it throws it a little off. And that is, instead of having each Perush separately, so if you're looking up something, you have to look at 20 different Meforshim, they were malakate, and they just put something at the end, so on one daf, you can see all the commentaries, except for the Marshah that they still kept separate. So you're not going to see the separate people anymore. And in terms of learning, which is the Iker, that is a good thing, actually. Because if I want to know what the different Meforshim say, I can just look up the daf, and I can see it, instead of having to look here, then look here, look here, look here, look here. But the Cheshek Shlomo asks the Gevaldik Akasha on the Gra. Wait a second here. The rule that the shir of a Yom Tov is Doche the shir Shel Yom, that's a rule regarding the Musaf. Meaning like this, if you're in the Beis HaMikdash and it's Yom Tov, so what did you bring? You brought the Korban Tumid of the morning, then you brought the Musaf. In the Musaf you said the Shir of Yom Tov. But in the Korban Tumid of the morning, you certainly said the Shir Shel Yom. So the Cheshek Shlomo says, if indeed in the Beis HaMikdash Gufa, you said the Shir Shel Yom, for the Korban Tumid of Shacharis, and you said the Shir Shel Yom Tov for the Musaf, then why does the Gra say you only say one Shir? So the Nitziv actually answers one anomaly with another. Well, that's fine, but since we only say a Shir after Musaf, we Ashkenazim say the Shir after Musaf, after Musaf you would say the Shir Shel Yom Tov. Now, that doesn't answer why shouldn't we follow Nusach Sfar. In other words, the most logical minhag would be after Shachris, say the Shir Shel Yom, and after Musaf, say the Shir Shel Yom Tov. But given the reality, in other words, we're not explaining the reality, given the reality that we only say the Shir Shel Yom after Musaf, the Gra says you got to do what they would do after Musaf. After Musaf, they said the Shir Shel Yom, the Shir Shel Yom Tov. But it is important to know that this rule, that the Shir of Yom Tov supersedes the Shir Shel Yom in the Mikdash, only applied to the Musaf. After Shachris, the Tumid of Shachris, they did say the Shir Shel Chol. But as I say, the Gra says, now given Minhag Ashkenaz, that we only say a Shir afterwards, after Musaf, that is why we say Shir Shel, that's why we say Shir Shel Yom Tov. Okay? Now it could be that the standard Ashkenazic minhag, the standard Ashkenazic minhag is actually difficult to understand. The standard Ashkenazic minhag is we only say Shir Shel Yom. Now I can understand why we would say both, but the only day that we say two is Rosh Chodesh. This is taka difficult to understand. Rosh Chodesh, the standard nusach is we say Shir Shel Yom and Borchi Nafshi, which is the Shir of Rosh Chodesh. But why do we only say the Shir of Rosh Chodesh? Why don't we say the Shir of the first day of Pesach and the second day of Pesach? In other words, all of the Shirim that the Gaon tells us, because they were said in the Beis HaMikdash. That's a bit of a tzarchin. Why is it only Barchi Nafshi that survived the cut? In other words, outside of the Minhag Yerushalayim and the like. But okay, but this is a little bit of history on this idea of the Shir Shel Yom. Okay. Okay, maybe we will stop here. And then of the third mitzvah, of course, is the mitzvah of tzitzis. We went over that, and that will lead us directly into Korach, because we know that the failure of Korach was that he asked Moshe Rabbeinu, tzitzis have to have blue and white. What if you had a garment that's totally techeilus? Do you need tzitzis? Moshe said yes, and Korach said, if a little bit of techeilus is good enough, then all techeilus should even be better. And Korach is really being merames that techeilus represents righteousness, holiness, leadership. We're all techeilus. We don't need special leaders and the like. And we'll see that Korach is asserting what you might call, what Rav Soloveitchik calls, the common sense rebellion. That everybody is holy, everybody's a judge, every person is entitled to Paskin Halacha. Korach's mistake is a mistake that very much exists even today. Okay, we'll talk about it.